Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
And Candace LePage.
And Peter Salmon.
That was super smooth. We're doing a group call for our year-end show, so this is going to be really exciting. And yeah, we will see if the tech holds up for the next hour. I have my fingers crossed it will. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be no one review. It will be our top fives of 2020. And maybe to begin, you know, let's get a feel for the room, and we'll start with Tim. How did you feel the year in movies went, you know, despite the fact that 10 months of that wasn't in a theater, you know, how do you feel about the year? How are you feeling going into this show?
I'm feeling good. I discovered a number of new movies recently, actually prepping for this show. Prior to that, it's a bit different, right? It's all you're streaming everything and there aren't those big Hollywood releases, so you're sort of trying to discover those little gems. And I think it helped this year because there a lot more attention's going to maybe smaller films, not just the big Hollywood releases. So, yeah, I was able to discover some of those as I swam through a lot of stuff online that and maybe saw some junk along the way, but I was able to find a few gems in there, that's for sure.
And Candace, how do you feel about the junk this year?
Well, you know, I do sort of feel a little bit the same way as Tim, that it's been an interesting year that has maybe showcased movies that I wouldn't have watched or, you know, might have just sort of held in my watch list forever until that day I finally realize, okay, I'm never going to watch this. I should just take it out of my list. But yeah, I mean, as much as I have missed going to the theater, it's really given me an opportunity to go back to either films that I missed the first time around. And the first time around might have been as much as like 30 years ago. But, you know, films I missed the first time around. And then also things that I, you know, wouldn't pay a movie ticket to go to. And not that that's anything against the movie. It's just that it's a big, you know, I take the bus, I gotta get there, it's hours out of my day, cost me popcorn, because you know you can't not have popcorn, even if it's the first movie of Saturday morning, which means you're basically having popcorn for brunch. So, yeah, it's been an interesting year for me for movie watching.
And Peter, bring us home. How do you feel about the year at the movies, or not at the movies, as it were?
It was okay. It was all right. I'm not gonna lie. Like you guys said, I really missed the theaters, the popcorn mainly. At home, you know, I guess I could self-layer it, but they do it so much better with the butter there. And I miss it. I really do. But like you both said, there's some great streaming. It really helped me dive deeper into Crave TV and Tubi. It's free, right? It's great. So yeah, it helped me find something. It helped me find some more indie things that I think maybe even the bookshelf wouldn't show. So help me find something new, but is that worth the lack of popcorn? So, but it was okay. It was okay.
And what a rousing.
I think we got a couple things earlier, or if not earlier, I was able to view them earlier because it's like music. You listen to it or watch it right at midnight. So that was kind of a benefit too. But yeah, I miss it. I'm very glad that I got to see Tenet.
Let's get into actually naming some movies for 2020, starting with our number five and going in broadcast order. We will start with Tim. Tim, what is your number five?
Okay, I just wanted to preface this by saying I'm not a huge fan of popcorn. I find it gets stuck in my teeth and I'm not, yeah, it's a shocker. And sometimes when I'm at the movies, when people are just chomping and you just hear the chomping, it kind of distracts me from what I'm trying to watch. But It can be tasty on occasion, just not every time for me. So I'll just say that.
You're forgiven.
I do like Junior Mints, and I do like some of the candy you can get there. So I like that. I would say for my top five, I'm taking the lead from you, Adam, last year, because I actually have a tie for number five, because you set a precedent last year, but I'm not going to go too long on it. But number five, I'd say the first one, I'd get the party started with Lover's Rock, which I watched on Amazon Prime. It's a 1 hour and 8 minute movie. It's only 68 minutes. And it's about a dance party in West London with a group of really exuberant Caribbean revelers. They're all like first and second generation. And it just shows, it's like almost like documentary style. It's showing what happens preparing for the party, at the party, how much fun they're having. And it's called Lover's Rock because that was a genre. I guess it continues to be a genre of reggae music, and it takes place in 1980. And I think even though it's kind of low budget, I thought it was really big on charm. And there's a song in there called Silly Games by Janet Kay, which I added to my playlist right after watching the movie. And it's used quite well in the film. Early on, there's a scene where they're preparing food for the party in the kitchen, and they're singing Silly Games a cappella. And it's really cool because they're all trying to sing their best. It's like, it's karaoke for them. And the one woman, she can hit all the high notes. So she's like the star, and the others are struggling to hit those notes. And then later in the film, there's a great scene where they're all dancing to Silly Games. So I guess this song's probably been out for a year. They all know the words. They're all singing along, and they just stop the music. And they just, everybody in the crowd just sings it. And it goes on. I don't know how long that scene is, but they're just singing their hearts out, stomping their feet, singing that song. And you really get a sense like you're there, like you're part of the party, which I found really cool. And it goes on so long that at one point, like, I turned to my wife and said, when's this going to end? And right there is when they cut the scene. So it was perfect. So I definitely recommend that. And then the other film is also a period piece from the 1950s, taking place in New Mexico, and it's called The Vast of Night. It's a science fiction film. It's low budget. It's from first-time director Andrew Patterson, and it uses an interesting device. It starts off like a Twilight Zone episode, but they use a different name because they probably couldn't use Twilight Zone. They use a different name. And it involves two protagonists. There's a young switchboard operator and there's a radio DJ, and they're hearing a mysterious audio sound. It's coming through the switchboard and it's coming through the radio, and they think it might be extraterrestrials. And there's a scene where a caller calls in to the radio station to say he has inside information on the sound and the UFOs, and he's ex-military, and he calls in. And it's a really cool scene because they never show him. They just show the reaction of the protagonist. They show like the switchboard. They show the radio. And it's really interesting to just listen. And I really like movies like that where you might not see all the visuals and you just hear the sound for that. And that's an extended scene. And that's on Amazon Prime as well. So I definitely recommend those two films. And you could probably watch them in one sitting. They're just over an hour. Yeah, Lover's Rock and The Vast of Night, number five.
All right. Tim opens up with the cheating by having a tie at number five. Candace, what is your number five?
Yeah, so I'm not cheating this year. I have certainly cheated in other top fives and that sort of stuff, but I went classic this year. I will give everybody two warnings. One is that I have been watching every single Hallmark holiday movie for the last couple of weeks. I've seen 19 films so far of their group of 40, and I will just give you the heads up right now. Not a single one of them has made my top five list for the year.
Well, thank you for your service.
It's surprising. What has that done to your mind?
I'm not entirely sure yet. I think I'm still, I think I still have to wait a little further to get really Stockholm syndrome, as Adam called it last week. And then the other warning is that, not a big surprise, four out of my five top films this year are in the horror genre. I really tried to get different things, but it just didn't happen. I do have one on my list, but we'll talk about that one later. All right. So for my top, my number five film, honestly, four and five have really kind of gone back and forth. I'm not sure entirely which one is which, but let's just say Vampires versus the Bronx for the first one. I think it's sort of the most fun type of horror film. The one that's PG-13, you can share it with kids. And, you know, if you ask any horror fan like myself, any big time horror fan, we all have stories of, you know, those films that we saw as a kid that are horror. And many of them are Poltergeist, which was also PG-13, but possibly a little more scarring than Vampires versus the Bronx. But so it's great. You know, it's a nice sort of family film with some scare in it, but also has really wraps up a lot of what I think many of us have been forced to deal with in 2020 about, you know, people on the edges of society and whether or not they belong, racial profiling and injustice, that sort of stuff. It does just a really great job as a simple kids versus vampires movie of really making it layered. There's always more to it. I'm sorry I can't go on longer about it, but I'll leave more space for Tim for his four and five.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, I have ties for every position on the list. I hope that's okay.
Well, we'll have to see what Peter, maybe Peter went the opposite way and only has a top one. Anyway, Peter, do you have a top five? And if you do, what is it?
I do have a top five. I'm sorry I didn't go in a more artsy direction with just one. Also, I want to say for Hallmark, I actually watched A Christmas Tree Grows in Colorado. And it was a fun ride. So, you know, that's not number five, but I don't not recommend it. It was fun. Does he get with the mayor's daughter? Does he? We'll have to find out yourself. But my fifth most favorite was First Cow. Yeah, I just really enjoyed it. And I think this is one I would not have seen in theaters. If so, it would have been The Bookshelf and maybe even, you know, 2021. And yeah, it's just, it had been since 2019, Sword of Trust, where I'd seen a really good kind of mumblecore film. And that's my jam, right? And First Cow is definitely what it is. There's a real minimal amount of audio, but the visuals really pay off. One thing I do want to say, if anybody has a Sony TV, maybe watch it on your computer or somewhere else. Sony has a darker black than any other TVs, and it made First Cow a little too black. Because it's, like I said, it's minimal. They don't have extra lighting, so the scenes outside are... It's pretty dark. It made it more real, but maybe watch it on a laptop. but it just, yeah, had a lot of artistic choices I enjoyed. The 4x3 can be a little pretentious, but I really think it worked out well for these visuals. It kind of had me thinking about the Group of Seven or Tom Thompson the whole time. The whole film looked like a painting of them, and I love their work. And just the acting was great. Minimal audio, but the facial expressions from Cookie, Otis Cookie, Figulote or some last name like that, he was a really great performance. And just another, it's a mumblecore, so a lot of the other elements of realism were great. There was when the First Nations, or it's the states, when the Native Americans would speak, there's no subtitles, right? So I enjoyed that. You know, it helps you feel like the other people that are like settling the land and have no idea who they're working with, right? Just the 4x3, the realism, and just a really beautiful film. Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen A Christmas Tree Grows in Colorado, but I can practically guarantee that the mayor's daughter and the other guy end up together, because that is the formula.
Spoiler.
Anyway, for my number five, I also have, like Candace, a predominantly black story out of New York City, except my pick is the 40-year-old version, which is the Rhonda Blank semi-autobiographical movie. it's black and white, so it has this kind of tinge of artistic snobbery to it, and there is definitely a bit of that, but it is well-used black and white, I have to say. It's a beautiful film. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's got a great message. It's got a great voice in Rada Black. I think she will be someone we will pay attention to in the future, and yeah, it's great. It's a great film. Funny. It's engaging. It's got a message, and a lot of great character actors too. People you may not be familiar with. And like I said, it's an exciting new voice in cinema. So that's my number five, which means we get to move to number four. And Tim, regale us with your number four.
So number four, I have a three-way tie. No, I'm just kidding. My number four is Da Five Bloods, Spike Lee's story of the four aging Vietnam War veterans who return to Vietnam to search for the remains of their leader, Stormin' Norman. And I thought especially the performance by Delroy Lindo as the MAGA hat-wearing Trump supporter who's just got a lot of issues and PTSD, and he was really affected all those years ago by the death of his friend Stormin' Norman. I think that's a great performance. And I imagine during award season, you'll probably be recognized. And I thought it was really cool. One device the movie uses, having the 60-year-olds play their 20-year-old versions of themselves. And I thought that's really interesting. I think it kind of shows how we never really truly grow up. And we're always, a lot of our vivid memories are from when we were younger. And I can only imagine how vivid those memories would be if you were dealing with the horrors of war in Vietnam. So I really liked how Spike Lee did that. I thought that was an interesting element. And yeah, it's a great film, and it's been on Netflix for a while now. So it's right there for anybody to see, and definitely recommend it.
Perfect. We may hear more about Da Five Bloods later, speaking of spoilers. But Candace, what is your number four?
So my number four is a film that I loved so much when I watched it that I made Adam watch it so we could cover it on the show. You know, in almost every other case, it's been sort of like, oh, what should we watch? I don't know. Let me look for something. But this one I saw and just knew I wanted to talk about it. So Satanic Panic is my number four pick. It is a horror comedy where Rebecca Romijn I said it in our review, but there's just no other words. She just like relished in this role, and it looked like with every line she was delivering, she was just ready to sort of lick her lips and go, that was delicious, just to be able to do that. It was so over the top, you know, sort of villainy from her. And so that part was great and hilarious. But then the entire, like the dialogue of the entire thing, these weird, weird decisions that somehow actually worked. If you haven't watched it, just remember bunnies. I don't know, it's weird, but it works. And it was just so much fun to watch. And that also, you know, sort of hearkening back to when we were talking about what this year in film has been like, this movie, more than almost any other movie I watched this year, I really enjoyed the sort of live watching of it. So I did a lot of Netflix parties with friends, but I also did a lot of Shudder live streaming, where it's sort of announced and everybody just gets on Twitter and streams along and tweets along. In fact, I just did that last night, because, thank God Joe Bob Briggs has come back, this year with a vengeance, basically. But, having, you know, missed the movie theater experience, I think that the, watching things live together with the rest of the world, has really been something I look forward to every week now.
Yeah, Shudder's been really good at sort of trying to capture that that experience, especially with horror movies, which tend to be more fun with an audience. If you ever go to like a midnight movie, or you go to like the Midnight Madness at TIFF, that's, you know, that's an audience experience as much as a film experience. Peter, your number four, please.
All right. My number four is Borat, subsequent movie film. I just loved it. I've always loved the Sacha Baron Cohen. So even though I'm usually really hesitant towards a sequel, I think that's part of the reason it's on my list. It's better than the first. It really is. It's a sequel. That's such an accomplishment, right? Also, I didn't know when we were reviewing this, Adam, but it's by Jason Waliner, the director. And I've absolutely loved Human Giants since way back in the day. So that further makes sense why I love it. And anybody, if you enjoyed that show, it's as funny as it, you know? And I think a real standout for me and what we mentioned is Maria Bakalova. She stood out. She was phenomenal. I think the greatest scene was the one where she goes to the Women's Republican meeting. That's something, and the way they act is something you wouldn't see with Sacha Baron Cohen, right? They were just, yeah, fully themselves, and it was very interesting to see, and very impressive on her part too. There's a scene where she goes in, and you could tell she's freaking out about it. It's so scary, but she does it, you know, and that's just, I'd never be able to be that brave. So she did great, and again, it paid off in the sense that there was something just as crazy as the first, if not more so. I know everybody's talking about it, but the Giuliani, it stands out for sure. And the one that not enough people talk about, there's the one guy who tries to help him traffic, essentially. The guy might have known it was like a joke and carried on, but he literally seems like he's very okay with helping Borat do some trafficking. So just a real, real success on Sacha Baron Cohen's part. And I'm really glad that, I guess because of the COVID, it came out maybe earlier the next year. So I am glad I was able to see it. And I think Borat, Amazon Prime is cheaper than going to the theater. So I think a wider amount was able to see it, which I think is great too. So yeah, number four, Borat.
Yeah, Borat 2 was something of a minor miracle that they were able to make a Borat sequel to begin with, because the character is so ubiquitous. My number four is very not Borat. It did technically, I suppose, come out in 2019, but it went wide in 2020. So, and I saw it in 2020, so it's on my list. It is Portrait of a Lady on Fire, the Celine Sciamma film about a woman who is hired to paint the portrait of another woman who is getting married, and the romance that sparks between them. What I find so engaging about it is that it's very passionate, but at the same time, it's very realistic about whether or not two women would end up together in the 17th century. I mean, obviously that's a cultural impossibility of the time, but, it's very unsentimental about it. Like, there's really no regret at the end. And a lot of that goes back to the, Euripides, the mythology there that they discuss in the movie about, you know, don't look back. And it makes me shudder just thinking about it. It is such a beautiful movie, and part of the reason there is the Claire Mathon cinematography. She makes the night come alive. Peter mentioned First Cow, which is naturalistic in that it is dark in the Oregon frontier in 1820s, at the same time, Claire Mathon shoots night scenes that really come alive, even though there is minimal light used. It you can still feel the texture and see the faces, and she really makes the night come alive without making it feel like there were big studio lights just off screen. So Portrait of a Lady on Fire is my number four, which brings us to number three and back to Tim. And Tim, what do you have for number three?
Yeah, and I would say I saw Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I don't know when. It all blends together, I think. But it's really, really good film, and I agree that cinematography was amazing in that. My number three is I'm Thinking of Ending Things by Charlie Kaufman. I was a bit hesitant to watch this film, and I think, Adam, you suggested it to me at one point, and I'm like, no, I'll pick something else, because I really like Charlie Kaufman when he worked with Spike Jones, like Adaptation, Being John Malkovich, and I'd seen a couple of his earlier directorial efforts, and I just didn't give him a chance. I kind of like turned them off, but this one, I really thought it was very interesting. It's one of those ones where it's just full of ideas. He probably goes a bit overboard in certain sections, but I just thought it was great how he just puts in like what he thinks about relationships, about memory, about the evolution of relationships and time. And I thought it keeps your attention even when it goes down like the most like philosophical sort of rabbit holes. And I quite enjoyed it. And it has two of my favorite actors in it, Jesse Buckley, who was in Wild Rose, and she's amazing, and Jesse Plemons, who from Friday Night Lights and Breaking Bad, and he's such a great actor, and he's so naturalistic too. And it was one of those things, it's hard for me to describe, and it's one of those movies where a lot of people will watch and say, what does that mean, or what's it about when it ends? But I just thought it kept my attention, and it really dived into a lot of interesting, you know, they talk about science one minute or art the next or what have you. So he's just laying his pretty much heart and mind out there. And I really respect Charlie Kaufman for doing that. So I'm Thinking of Ending Things is number three on my list.
Very cool. Candace, you're number three.
Yeah, so my number three is one of the few movies that was actually filmed this year and during the height of people's sort of stay-at-home quarantine time. So my number three is the film Host, which is a tight 57-minute-long horror film with six friends all on a Zoom call. And so it was also filmed all through Zoom. Everybody was in their own place. People were acting against each other in the Zoom call, having no idea what chaos was going to happen in their friends' Zoom. Six friends get together to do an online seance, which sounds like the worst idea ever. And that's exactly how it played out. That's the worst idea ever. It was just such a great use of technology. And I know that there's been a lot of things over the last few years about, you know, people having live streaming or doing cam girl sort of stuff. All of those, I've rarely watched them, mostly because I've heard a lot of bad things from people about how it just, the technology just doesn't really cut it. It isn't really very scary. It's not very well done. But Host has just, it's intrigued me to go to those things to watch it because Host was so well done. And it seems like the sort of director and writers behind it all just sort of come from the indie world. They really don't have a lot of big, big projects behind them. And I think that is really what the difference is. Because they're from a place where they're used to working with less resources, they're able to craft a really good story. And the 57 minutes of it, that part is just great and really makes it feel very real too, because it's on Zoom, and if you have a free Zoom account, it's 45 minutes and then the timer goes off and you're out of the call. So I was really impressed by this film.
Cool. Peter, you're number three.
Yeah. My number three is, it's already been stolen by Adam A. Donaldson, but The 40-Year-Old Virgin. It was so good. It really was. One thing you didn't mention, it's black and white, which it's kind of like what I was talking about, The First Cow. That can be a little pretentious, but I thought it worked out here. It just made, made everything more vibrant. I don't know. There wasn't really any reason either, but I loved it. The one thing too that we mentioned it when we were watching it, we kind of just assumed it was kind of like a racial thing, right? To show a more firm kind of the separation, or at least the separation viewed by others, black and white. And the one interview, she's like, no, that's not the reason, I never even thought about that. She just likes the black and white, and it's great. But like you were saying, mainly kind of like how First of Cow was more minimal and focused on the visuals, this was a lot of really great deep discussions from her and a focus on her as an individual, which was really phenomenal. And I forget, here, let me, what was his character's name? But her relationship with what was his name? Either way, the relationship that she had with her boyfriend was really great. He didn't really talk much, like, at all, but the relationship was, well, that was kind of why it was great. It was still a focus on her, right? I thought the Brendan in rap was really cool, too. Very, of course, present. And writer's block, even though I don't write hip-hop, you know, I'm still in school. I'm in history. I have to write a crap ton. And so I related to that. A writer's block, something I could definitely relate to. Yeah, and it's just a focus. I'm always okay if it's focused on a nice New York suburb. You mentioned Defy Bloods. It's Spike Lee. I love when they're ever, you know, in a New York suburb. So just a bunch of elements that I love and all perfectly put together. Yeah. It's a 4-year-old version, number 3.
All right. And my number 3 has also been already mentioned. It is Defy Bloods. Weirdly enough, I mean, I remember when this came out and Tim and I reviewed it. It was like June. It was early June. And it was like right after the Black Lives Matter resurgence started. So it was like just super timely, and I know that wasn't part of the plan, but it did help the movie land in a really unusual and unexpected way. Having said that, though, I feel like it is Spike Lee at his most commercial, and I don't mean that as a bad thing. I mean it whether it's the time or whether it's Spike Lee having won his Oscar and maybe is feeling in a more mainstream mood. He made something that's like really accessible, and that part of that may be the package he has. I mean, there's a lot of the social commentary Spike does, but and the late great Chadwick Boseman as Storm and Norman, I feel like his unfortunate and untimely death, plus like sort of the circumstances that he had cancer for years and was fighting cancer as he was like doing all this acting, and to look back at his role in Defy Bloods, where he is like the mythic CEO of this group who they treat with such reverence, it really adds like another unexpected real life layer to the movie that Spike Lee didn't intend, but now it kind of wears. And I've been thinking a lot about that since Chadwick Boseman passed away. Anyway, we will have to take a break here because we are halfway through the list. And we will come back in a sec. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. To invite all of the frustration that you can, man, you always have cowled around. Everything is better with cows around. Living in town sometimes brings me down. Let me bestow this western blessing, leave you settle down, but you always have cows around. What else can make the bishop swear like a sailor might? What else can cause such...
War is about money. Money is about war. Every time I walk out my front door, see cops patrolling my neighborhood like it's some kind of police state, I can feel just how much I ain't worth.
Gave us something to believe in. A direction, a purpose. He taught us about Black history when it wasn't really popular back then. Schooled us about drinking that anti-commie Kool-Aid they were selling. Yeah, he was our Malcolm and our Martin. Norm had a way of keeping us from going off.
He wasn't no Tom. He was a bad mother. Shut your mouth.
And that was a clip from Defy Bloods. It's the new film from Spike Lee, and it came out on Netflix earlier this year. Will it appear on any more top 5 lists in this year's top 5 list of our panelists? We will see in a second. In the meantime, let us move on. So, Tim, why don't you start us with the next round and with your number 2 pick?
Thanks, Adam. So my second one was Stolen by Peter. Like milk from a teat, and it is First Cow. And I thought it's a quiet and beautiful film. It's a slow movie, which I like. It takes its time, like Peter was saying, you know, and there isn't a ton of dialogue. It's just it just evolves, and you can see how it evolves and how the friendship evolves. It's really a story about friendship, about struggling with poverty and sort of like a class system. There's an underlying element of that, but it really focuses on the friendship between Cookie, the chef with a great nickname, and Lou, who I'll call the world traveler, and Kelly Reichardt directed it. And I think she did an excellent job just letting the movie breathe, you know, just like Peter is comparing it to Mumblecore and stuff, just movies that just about people, let it breathe. This is what they go through. These are their challenges. And it's a great sort of heist film in a way, too, regarding milk. And I really liked it. So First Cow is number two on my list.
Okay, and that metaphor to set it up, I tell you, really, I could tell you really put a lot of work into setting that up. I appreciate it. So Candace, I hope you have an equally great segue for your number two.
Unfortunately, I don't. However, I will give props to Tim. Thank goodness my microphone was off, because that literally made me snort. Well done. And now let's move into the bummer of a movie. The first film I saw this year remains, you know, in my top five, and actually so high right now at number two, and that's Just Mercy. The film about, sort of biopic of Bryan Stevenson, starting the, what's the name of that organization, but the sort of civil liberties organization that he has. It's set in the 80s and follows a number of people who are incarcerated through sort of varying things. Some of them are totally, like, falsely accused. Some of them are rightly incarcerated, but have sentences that are just completely outside of the realm of what should be relevant to their crime. And the film was just amazing. The acting was great. I thought they just did such a great job of just leaving space and forcing you to sit with the thoughts that you have and that are brought up. And, you know, I spent a lot of time through June, July, and August recommending this film to everybody I could recommend. It's just, to me, it's necessary viewing. Who knew that a film that came out at the very end of 2019, it only sort of was released internationally in 2020, but who knew that a film that came out at the beginning of this year was going to be so incredibly relevant to where we are? I don't know. I just think everybody should watch this film and think about it.
Yeah, Bryan Stevenson's organization is called the Equal Justice Initiative, which is it's still sadly very busy out of its home base in Alabama. And yeah, I mean that's another one of those things, because of the circumstances this year where it became even more relevant and was even more impactful. And it came out on Crave, like, I think earlier in this fall. And so I rewatched it again, and it's actually even more impactful now. Mm-hmm. At least that's how I found it. It's not that it wasn't impactful when it came out in January, but you know, it carries even more weight.
Yeah, and I will say a bit of a double blow as well, because obviously there's the racial injustice issue of these people who are being held for crimes. But then there's also, talking about COVID and about what rights do people have to being safe from a virus, and their, you know, congregant living is really at risk. And everybody's talking about certain types of congregant living, and a lot of people aren't talking about prisoners.
Right, exactly. Well, on that down note, Peter, what is your number two?
So we're on number two, and I picked, already been taken, y'all are Steelers, to Five Bloods. It's so good, right? And I just want to say it's a great Spike Lee film. And like you said, possibly his biggest blockbuster. I think maybe Old Boy was an attempt towards a bigger blockbuster, but this one definitely paid off. Yeah, it was on our top 10 streaming on Netflix for a long time. And one thing I really loved, like you both said, the acting from, Delroy Lindo was great. But the relationship between his character and his son was what really stood out to me. It was phenomenal. And I hadn't seen his son in anything before. I know he's on a Showtime show, I think, or something. But the relationship was outstanding. And especially there's the one mind scene. And that's one where it's really a close connection between them. And it's very well done. And also of that mind scene, I want to say Defy Bloods has a few surprises, you know? It's like a Spike Lee film, like a lot of his. It does have a lot of more of an art focus. Where I focus on the acting and the high quality of that nature. But it's shocking. There's a couple shocks. There's a couple things you would not expect. And I thought that was a really good payoff. It could fail, but it really succeeded in Defy Bloods. And I think all the other actors, too, had some really interesting stories. The one had, I don't want to spoil anything, but family he maybe wasn't aware of or something. It's great. They all have their own thing, their own little sticks going on, and it really is phenomenal. Yeah, and I would say his best in a while, too, not just, like, I wasn't a huge fan of Chirac. I would say this one really good. And Chadwick Boseman really, really loved him and wanted to be on this. So not only did I love his part, I'm really glad that he got it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Majors is the actor you're thinking of who played the son. And he was in Lovecraft Country. So
is that the same name as the first film that one of you picked?
Lovecraft Country? I think you're thinking of Lover's Rock.
Okay.
Very different different material. Anyway, since we're all stealing from each other, my number two is First Cow. I don't know what else I can add. I'm glad Tim name-checked Kelly Reichardt because she put together something that was really remarkable. It is ostensibly a movie about stealing milk to make biscuits and get rich making biscuits in 1820 Oregon. And if you didn't think you could make an engaging movie about that subject matter, boy, are you wrong. It is so much fun to sort of watch these two, you know, basically, you know, frontier hustlers having to go to the trouble of stealing milk from the only cow for miles and then taking it back to the village. Or basically the encampment that's been set up and like selling these biscuits and selling the biscuits to the man who owns the cow and to see him like enjoy the biscuits and like, wow, this is so great. It's like a real taste of London and the whole dodge and hustle of it. And then, the last bit, which is extensively when the hustle goes wrong and they get caught, mid milk theft, and it turns into like this kind of edge of your seat little action thriller as they're like on the run from the mob who are out to try and get them for stealing the milk. It is something else entirely. It is such a technically well put together film. It makes you feel that loneliness and isolation, but at the same time, it's a movie about a really great male friendship that doesn't have any of the typical things like despite everything. They stick together literally to the end, Cookie and King Lou. So I found it oddly life-affirming, this tale of milk theft. Anyway, that brings us to the number one choice, all of our number one choices. So, Tim, take it away with your number one.
So for this one, Peter and Adam stole my rhyme. It's the 40-year-old version. I really like this film, just like you guys did. Written and directed by Radha Blank, tells a story. I really like it. Tells a story of like pursuing artistic dreams past 40 years old too, which is interesting. You don't see that very often. She had won the award 30 Under 30 for her playwriting earlier in her life, and now she'd been sort of struggling since then. So I thought it was an interesting universal story. Doesn't matter, you know, where you are or what background you come from, just trying to pursue the arts and doing it later in life. And yeah, I loved how raw and emotionally honest the film was and how funny it was and really frank. It pulled no punches, you know, and a lot of the time that led to great humor. And I like the title, although I think I might have called something else, because I think when you Google it, you get like 40-year-old virgin, you know. It's good. She's, and I don't think her film's so good she doesn't really need to use that as like a stepping stone or anything. I think her film's great on its own. And yeah, and I would definitely like to see what she does next, because I liked it. And I think there might be some criticism, you know, it's kind of a long film. It's a little over 2 hours, but I was engaged the whole time. And I like that she was just, you know, just going for it and doing what she wanted to do. It seemed like she had a lot of freedom to make this film, which is really cool for a low budget film like that. So 40-year-old version, number one for me. Thanks.
Perfect. And so Candace, what do you have for us for number one?
Yeah. So sitting here listening to the three of you reminds me, one of the reasons that I really like doing this show in the past is because it's introduced me to films that I wouldn't normally go see, or I wouldn't take the time to go see. However, this year, Adam has put each of us into our own driver's seat. So I have remained pretty firm in the horror camp this year. And I'm okay with that. It's been a rough year. The familiarity of my entertainment choices has been one of the things that has helped me get through. But clearly, I need to watch The First Cow, To Five Bloods, and the 40-year-old version. So none of those three films is my number one. My number one pick for this year is Blood Quantum, which is another horror film with a social justice angle. It's a zombie film that sort of pits, you know, in this fictionalized world where it's not like this at all in the real world, but pits First Nations against settlers in this land that currently has a virus that First Nations people are not susceptible to. So as white people across Canada, I mean, they don't really say what country it is, but it is a Canadian film. So as white people across Canada are turning into flesh-eating zombies, people are seeking refuge in this First Nations camp where everybody there is healthy and good. And so, you know, there's a lot of layers there with that. It's also just a fun zombie film that's incredibly bloody. Like, it might rival The Shining for most blood used in a film. I'm not sure. I know Stanley Kubrick feels pretty proud of his amount of blood use in The Shining, but it's so, you know, you can watch it just for the fun zombiness of it. You can watch it for some of the, you know, the story of the eternal story of First Nations genocide, which is, you know, sort of what's going on. First Nations people have been through the apocalypse a number of times in North America, and yet they continue to survive. And so hopefully we can learn from that, either stop trying to kill them or actually learn some resilience of our own.
Yeah, Blood Quantum's actually on my honorable mentions list for the year. So it's still powerful. I went into that not necessarily because of the people involved, but in terms of the genre in general, thinking there was nothing left to say in the zombie genre. And I was wrong. Blood Quantum had a lot to say, and it was interesting. Well, Peter, that brings us to your number one, and I am very interested to know what that is.
It is not something taken, and I know this is going to be strange, Adam, because I think I watched it and claimed I didn't like it, but things for me weirdly can evolve, and it is now my favorite film of the year. I remember when I first watched it when I was like 11, I really did not like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, it's not my most favorite film of all time. So I swear this is not something new. I don't know why that happened. I think I keep thinking about it, and that's when I realized, like, okay, yeah, I like that. So what I picked, and I did, I gave it the wrong name in a couple episodes, so it was a little offensive, I guess, but I choose Crip Camp, the new Netflix documentary, absolutely phenomenal reviews, and just a perfect documentary. I'm in history. I really love social history, and that's exactly what this film is. It just focuses on a really great social realm of the late 60s, 70s that hasn't been dealt with at all in the documentaries we've seen. The disabled, right? And literally a camp for people who are disabled, Crip Camp. And since it's the late 60s and 70s, these people, even though severely disabled, they just party. They just smoke a lot of pot and like make a lot of sweet, sweet love and love the 60s and 70s music. And yeah, it's all original footage too from them. So it's great just seeing them have a fun time. And in particular, social history, I love the 60s and 70s. And it focuses too on the late 60s, early 70s protestings, which are and riots, which are always really interesting, especially because at this period, it's when there was a huge surge of liberal terrorist groups. And so, you know, it does delve into the Weather Underground, their connection with those kinds of people and their own stunts. They were doing, you know, protests and riots, you know, ones that could be a little violent, but mainly they just like chilling and smoking pot, you know. But it was, so it was both of those fun aspects of the 60s.
Okay, perfect. And I do remember that wild ride for a while in the summer. Yeah. So my number one is, and it's one that nobody else has mentioned yet, so I have that going for me. It is Nobody Knows I'm Here, which Tim began talking about that song from Lover's Rock that got in his head. The song from Nobody Knows I'm Here, it is a similar feeling for me. I have not been able to get that song out of my head since we saw that movie in the summer. It is has a great central performance from Jorge Garcia, who gets to go like full dramatic. Usually he is like the comic relief in these dramatic series like Lost or you know, Once Upon a Time, which I think he was into. But in this, it's a full-on dramatic role. There's something the way that Jasper Antillo directed it that makes it seem like disturbing, like dangerous around every corner. And I guess that fits the main character's psyche. But it is actually a really homely kind of sweet drama about a man who, you know, has basically been traumatized by his brush with fame all over this song. He sang the song, but somebody else got famous for lip syncing it. It's kind of like a Milli Vanilli-ish scandal, I guess. But the music, even right now talking about it, that song is in my head. And it is like the best pop song that was never performed by a pop band. Whoever wrote it needs to get a record contract, because they will sell a million copies on iTunes and become a millionaire, because it's such a, the song is so great. But the movie that it is attached to is also really great, and their performances are really great. And Jorge Garcia, people need to let him stretch more. He's got chops, he's got talent, and that's what I take away from Nobody Knows I'm Here, is that song and Jorge Garcia as a dramatic thespian. So that brings us to the end of our list and the end of the show. So thank you, panel, for all the great recommendations, even the ones we stole from each other. it's been quite a year, and I think we all look forward to leaving our homes and going back to the movie theater with or without popcorn, because I do not want to relive that debate. We're at the end of the show. Anyway, we'll give everyone a chance to mention where they can be found on the internet. So, Tim, we will start with you. Where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, Tim Phillips, Flash in the Deadpan, and I vote for Junior Mints.
I said, no debate. And again, Candace, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's C-I-N-N-4-8, where I will continue my Hallmark movie-a-thon for the next, you know, half of the block. Keep watching. Yes, they will get together at the end.
PWS, where can people find you?
Mr. Tarak on good old YouTube and Twitter, and then on no judgment TikTok, Peter Wesley Salmon. So that full name. Yeah.
All right. And that's it for this week's show, and indeed this year's shows, and we hope you like them all, or at the very least liked most of them. But if you would like to listen to any of the previous year's episodes again, find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download the show from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday via Podbean or your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Speaking of Spotify, you can also find the playlist of the music we play here on End Credits every week, and just search End Credits on CFRU in your Spotify app to find that. You can also find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for our annual political awards show on Open Sources Guelph, and that is with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can find my Politico site at guelphpolitico.ca, and you can also read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street, nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back with another episode of the show next Wednesday at 3 p.m. See you back here for more end credits. And until then, well, Happy New Year.